the extra Sangha member.
Perfect Sangha member. Only listens, never speaks.
Best kind. So today is my way-seeking mind talk, which for the few of you who haven't heard one is basically will be my sense of how I got into this practice. And I wrote out, first of all, I found out in doing this that I have far more to share with you than I could share with you probably in the 50 hours of interviewing I might might do. So Ed and I talked about actually having the practice period focus on, obviously, our practice as lay practitioners, which we all are. We don't live in a monastic setting. And for me to kind of weave into, say, the next talk, which may be about my practice in my current life, kind of be able to not, you know, have this morning be a beginning, a middle, and an end of my conversation about my life. And I was thinking partly about why I've ended up having so much information I want to share with you. Mm-hmm. And really, you know, I've been practicing with you for years. And of course, when I give talks or when we talk together, we're not focused on the shape of our lives. You know, we don't ask a lot of the common questions that people ask each other when they're out in the world about, you know, oh, where did you go to school? How was that? You know, what's your family life like, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a rare opportunity in that sense, and I have felt this real instinct to share with you. So I wrote this out, and it occurred to me as I was writing it, of course, that I can make it sound like a story, as if it has, you know, a sequence that I actually followed. And of course, memory is notoriously inadequate to really tell what happened at any particular moment. And also, way seeking, from my experience, certainly is not a kind of and then, and then, and then. It feels much more like a kind of blind groping, a kind of mole-like activity that where you're kind of digging for some nourishment, some something you don't quite understand what you're reaching for, and it's based on an instinct which also isn't graspable. It's just there. So the story, to some extent, is by its nature a falsehood. I mean, it's not what actually happened, but of course, that's how we talk to each other. We talk to each other in stories and in words. So I'm going to actually start in the middle, but I want to say something about companionship. And I asked Ed if we could use that for a theme, because as I was thinking about what happened to me and how I got in this practice, I realized that a lot of it had to do with finding companions. And what companionship means to me is basically something like, you know, a companion is anyone who, or any being, or any thing, which of course includes poetry and music and stuff, that helps ground me, in my body, in my mind, and which helps me find a voice that feels right and helps me both express myself and be active in my life in ways that also feel nourishing to me and to the people around me. So for this practice period, you are my primary companions. It's your attentiveness, your dedication to your own practice that becomes the primary nourishment for me. And of course, that includes Ed. And it's a way in which I find it's in some sense the primary way I practice, which is with people. And when you're not right in front of me, you're also still with me. The conversation that I wrote out, you were there. And the stimulus of your commitment to be in this practice period was part of what is also embedded in that conversation. So, where I want to start is actually not where I was born in 1938 and follow it that way, but I want to start at the place at which I started to acquire companions myself, kind of meaningful relationships and meaningful direction. And for better or for worse, for me, that started when I came to California. I was born in Chicago and raised in New Jersey, but I didn't come here until I went to graduate school. And basically, when I left the East Coast, I didn't know what I was going to do. I had neither a job nor a clear sense of what kind of career I wanted. I was leaving. And at some point I'll talk about what I thought I was leaving, but I didn't even bring an address book with me, you know. I just actually went until my feet got wet in the Pacific Ocean. And then I stopped, and I spent about 6 to 9 months doing odd jobs and kind of settling. And then basically one day, walking on the hills in San Francisco, I looked across the bay and I said, I think I want to go to graduate school in Berkeley. So that's what I did. And this was 1962. Actually, it was a little earlier, but I mean, it was earlier in that year. Berkeley at that point was a sleepy little town. And the campus was virtually vacant, you know. It didn't feel like a large, bustling university. You know, the Daily Californian was full of information about pom-pom girls and fraternity houses. And I wrote a couple of letters to classmates on the East Coast, and I said, this is really weird. But it was also wonderful because through the grace of Pat Brown and the legislature, the university was actually funded in a way that allowed it to bring a lot of very fine professors to the West Coast. And the students, like me, I did it by accident, but a lot of people actually made a conscious choice to leave the East Coast, and leave their schooling there, and come out for graduate school. And so I had this very stimulating, academic environment, it was still a very traditional, you know, classroom-based environment, but I had companions with whom I could, you know, play music and socialize and have conversations about our chosen career. It was in the English department, because I at least felt I knew enough about English literature to be able to teach it if I was going to teach. And we could go out, we could play touch football and ice hockey. I mean, for an Easterner, not to be able to find an ice rink is a, you know, semi-disaster. And we could, of course, explore this incredible state. And in the 1960s, to be able to go out and hike in the Sierras, you didn't even need a pass or a weekend slip of some kind. You could just go. And I had maybe six or seven friends who loved to hike and camp. So that environment, the kind of stimulation of California, which itself felt like a kind of magical spot of infinite possibilities. And I can't quite say what it is about the shift from the East Coast to the West Coast, but there's a certain kind of tyranny of history, a kind of set of traditions which seem to limit the possibilities, whether they do or not. And of course, there's the mindset of the people I grew up with and the people with whom I shared my education. And essentially, I felt that I had been unable to find my own path on the East Coast in the particular way in which I had been educated and raised. And here, there seemed to be no limits in the same way. So I think in Berkeley, there were probably two or three major contributors to my education. Obviously, there were the kind of solid academics, which I appreciated, but I was pretty clear early on that doing classroom teaching the way most professors did it wasn't going to be the way I did it. The question was, how do I find out how I do it? And happily, there was college classmate of mine whom I didn't know in college named Walt Herbert. And he and his wife had both been to Union Theological Seminary and had become Methodist priests. And he had gotten a job. It was offered by the Glide Foundation, who wanted to experiment with something called campus ministry. So he shows up on the Berkeley campus in the fall of 62 and has this job. He doesn't know what he's going to do with it. So he decided, he knocked around, chatted with a number of us. He was a kind of inveterate pipe smoker at that point, so we'd sit in the sun and chat with various people, and he put together this group of about 10 of us from different disciplines. And he had the resources to invite a lot of educators who were doing interesting things from all across the country to meet with us. And I think the first few times we met, we were probably pretty deferential. But this went on for 5 years. And by the time the third or fourth person showed up, we were ready to clean their clocks about why they were doing the various things they were doing. And I began in that process to kind of get in touch with how I felt I could be an educator in a way that worked for me. And of course, the second or third major event in my graduate school career were the political uprising, starting with the free speech movement in 1964, fall of 64. My friend Walt Ack actually ended up being the facilitator of the steering committee for the free speech movement. I mean, this is a tiny campus. We knew, you know, each other, a lot of us, and a tiny group to start with of kind of people who were drawn to that kind of political form of expression. And what came out of it for me was a very clear sense, and there were, I'll give you one example, but a very clear sense that the most underutilized energy and skill on a university campus is, of course, the students. And if you, I mean, Reagan at some point later in the 60s, when Nixon was bombing Cambodia, decided he was going to close the university. And of course, what he did was give everybody who didn't care permission to leave. And there was no way he was going to get all the people who really cared to leave the university. So, you know, faculty went home, they were with their families. Everybody who wasn't engaged in the political dialogue left. And those of us who had keys to the offices opened them and, you know, produced stuff and communicated. And it was just such a vivid example of what happens when there's an agenda, a commitment, and the kind of energy that both the undergraduates and graduates could bring to a situation like that. So when I moved across the bay from Berkeley to San Francisco State, where I'd gotten a tenure track job, I came, and honestly, I don't think they knew much about who I was, and I felt I had been given the keys to a little kingdom because I could be my own boss. And when I arrived, I started, actually, I realized pretty quickly that, again, the university still was based on a kind of teacher-centered model of education. But I started cold calling foundations. And by the early spring of my first year as a professor, I had a grant from somebody I'm fond of calling my fairy godmother. She was a woman named Ruth Chance, who had graduated she was on the law review at Bolt. She ran this wonderful little foundation that had the flexibility and happily not much administration. She was basically it. And she had enough money to fund programs that she really cared about. And she grilled me mercilessly about what I was doing, but she funded me for 6 years and then helped me establish within the university 3 projects. And the first one, by the way, the other thing I did in graduate school that I hadn't mentioned was when I discovered that I wasn't particularly interested in doing teacher-centered education, I started, of course, in the 60s, there were lots of counter groups and group process classes, and I started, you know, going from one to the other. Finally, I ended up in the criminology department with this wonderfully wacky psychodramatist and his assistant, who was a woman named Mimi Silbert. And I don't know whether you know Mimi, but she has been for many years the head of Delancey Street. And she knew a lot of the nonprofits. So there were three organizations which I had money to found over the course of about 5 years in the early 1970s. One was the Center for Reading Improvement, and we ended up with about 350 tutors working in the public school system doing one-to-one tutoring. And we did testing, pre and post testing, and we, you know, worked with the school district. The second one was called the Center for Institutional Change, kind of, you know, I mean, we got a couple of calls from various organizations saying, exactly what institution are you trying to change? But we, Mimi was my partner on that particular grant. And we placed students in Delancey Street, West Side Lodge, which was a three-quarter way house for adult psychotics, two autistic programs for autistic children, a wonderful little program that didn't last very long in the East Bay called Diabasis, which was first break psychotic adolescents. And then we had a family an abuse program that dealt with both the kids and the adult abusers. And essentially what we were doing was we were bringing students in and we were interviewing them, establishing relationships for them with these various organizations. But in order to, obviously, I couldn't run around and take care of all this, these various groups doing their various things in all these organizations. So we deputized students and basically trained them to supervise the groups of students who were working on these service learning projects. And what it did was create a sangha on campus. It created a community. And it tapped into what is, if you think about a large campus like San Francisco State, where you have basically 28,000 mutually repellent particles wandering around this campus. And the way, if you can bring together groups of students who are really committed to a common project, the way we were in Berkeley around the politics, what you have a chance to create is a community. But of course, you then have to figure out how to give students who want to stay responsibility. The nice thing about getting off-campus grants is that universities can generally be bought. They can be bought by the Defense Department. They can be bought by outside institutions who are willing to give them money. So there were a number of rules that were in the way of setting up this kind of community. And one of them, of course, was contact hours. I was supposed to have 3 hours. I was supposed to have 1 hour of contact for every unit of credit that I gave every student. Well, we had a total at that point of 450 or 500 students working all over the city, some doing individual tutoring, some doing work in these agencies. There was no way. So the groups were supervised by students, and then we had some work study money, and we brought together basically a team of students who stayed with us for up to 4 or 5 years. We also created a social psychology graduate program so we could keep them, the staff members who wanted to stay working with us. So that was essentially my, I mean, I still occasionally taught a Shakespeare class. I still occasionally taught, you know, Elizabethan literature. I managed to survive several faculty committees. But the real heart of my own practice, in the most meaningful sense of that phrase, were these projects, which I felt they had really two, I had two reasons for doing them. One was educationally they made sense. It tapped into a vitality that students brought, both because they were curious about the world they were about to go into, and because they wanted community. They didn't want to be just, you know, running around from class to class. And they wanted the continuity which a semester system makes impossible, basically. I mean, being a teacher in the semester system really requires you make a choice. If you want to really create a trusting relationship with 30 people times four classes, if you're teaching a full load at San Francisco State, good luck. You can do it for one semester, maybe two semesters. But the burnout, doing that, I mean, I used to casually say, was at the beginning of a semester, that I was about to make 100 new relationships in the first week of the semester. It's not possible. So, of course, what happens is professors begin to take care of themselves and move away. And I felt it was so difficult to do that, and I, you know, so I found this other mechanism. And I basically had 30 or 35 staff members whom I could really get to know and work with over a period of years. And it's, of course, what I love about, it's one of the things I love about this. We have a common purpose, we have a small enough group to get to know each other, and we have the kind of discipline that allows us to stay together over years and help heal each other. And that's essentially what I felt I could do at the university in my particular way, funded by first my fairy godmother and then the university itself. They finally gave up and said, oh my God, you've got enough full-time equivalent, you know, people who signed up for classes, so I guess we have to take this on. So they're still there. These projects are still there. The third one, which I didn't mention, was something called the Peer Resources Centers, which got started in Galileo High School under a grant that came through my other fairy godmother, a woman named Gladys Thatcher, who ran the San Francisco Education Fund. She actually took two of my students and myself and herself into the boardroom of McKesson Corporation. And she asked the students to talk about their high school experience. And you could see the board members' eyes getting wide, you know. And they funded, over a course of years, something called the Peer Resources Centers, which were run by my students. And essentially, one of them did this for the rest of his career and is still doing it. Now it's an international project. But the idea was basically the same that we had at San Francisco State, and that is to get students engaged with each other, taking responsibility for each other, and creating communities within the high schools to take some of the alienation out of that difficult process for adolescents. So, the only missing piece for me, I felt good about my career, I felt good about you know, my life overall, but there was really a missing piece in my own education, and I knew it. I had been through the best that university life and college life had been able to offer me, and I still felt incomplete in a certain way. And my brother, who had been through the Vietnam War, although he had been sent to Germany and not to Vietnam, had gone across overland to India. And he invited me. He knew he spoke Hindi by that time. It had been in an ashram studying for 5 years. So he asked me to come to India, which I did in 1974, summer of 74. And he, said, leave all your stuff here. I'm going to put you in Congress Party whites, and we're going to travel on third-class buses, which we did. So I had, just before I left, contacted a Tibetan teacher in Berkeley and had talked to him and his wife, who was running the Tibetan Refugee Foundation. And I had letters to various teachers and some money and clothing and stuff to give them. So we went to various Nyingma temples and schools in northern India, and then I spent the rest of the time in the ashram. So my brother and I kind of split the summer, and he was my guide, and we had a wonderful time. And there were a couple of things that really, experiences that changed the direction in my life and brought me to Buddhist practice. They both had to do with people. We had gone to the Nyingma Institute in Dehradun, and it was a school for monks and young monks. And when we were there, we obviously were going to stay somewhere on the school campus, and the administrators brought me around. The meditation teacher, who was absent, had this lovely little meditation area and his bedroom, and they said, you sleep here. And I said, I looked around at all the kind of intimate objects of his life, and I couldn't do it. So I said, kind of lamely, I said, well, you know, my brother and I really like sleeping outdoors, we like the open air and so forth. They said, okay. So they took his bed out and they put it in the courtyard, and they all brought their sleeping bags and the little Tibetan dog that was part of the school, and we all slept outdoors. And I was in this big four-poster bed with Tibetan rugs hanging off of it and various kinds of things. And it was so deeply touching to me that just, you know, they didn't think about it. That is just how they did it. And later on, in a small place, small temple at Tashichang, the teacher we had come to see had actually just died. And they asked us to stay for the funeral. And so we stayed. And we were put in this little room, but the day of the funeral, when there were many teachers and little groups who came to be a part of the puja, the ceremonies for this teacher who had died. And they had to move us. So the night before, we moved all our stuff into this room, and then all of a sudden, these two teachers show up. They don't speak a word of English. We don't speak a word of Tibetan, except dashi dale, and you know, which is basically hi, how are you? And so we sit there for about an hour, swatting flies and smiling at each other. And then they get up and they leave. And what had happened in the process was that David and I had settled in our new room. And that's what they did. There was this kind of energy they brought, which they, I'm sure, understood way better than we did, that allowed us to settle. And when we were truly at home in our new quarters, they got up and bowed and left. And I started, when I got back to the United States, and even then, I started thinking, who are these guys? You know, what do they do? How do they learn to be that way with each other and with us? And so when I came back, I joined the Dharma Dhatu, which is one of Trungpa's places in Brooklyn when Trungpa was alive. Chogyam Trungpa, who was then teaching in Boulder, Colorado at the Naropa Institute. But the leadership there was earnest and completely inexperienced. And it became pretty clear to me that, you know, I mean, Trungpa would show up in his own way of being, which I won't try to describe, as sometimes drunk. And he was a brilliant teacher, and had he been in Berkeley, I might have stayed there and been a Tibet student of Tibetan Buddhism. But it was clear that without that leadership, I wasn't really going to understand the nature of practice the way I felt I needed to. So on one retreat in which Trungpa was wandering around, I said to somebody next to me, I said, you know, this really doesn't work for me. I can't stay in this practice. You should go to Zen Center. She actually lived a block away on 8th Street. And so the next week I went, and the man Ed talked about last week, Ed Brown, was the Tanta, was the head of practice at that point, opened the door for me, and became my gateway to Zen practice. And, you know, I was, stumbling around trying to find my way both into the practice and into sesshins and then eventually into Tassajara. And he was always there with this look that said in part, are you sure you want to do this? in part, you know, this kind of warm, dark-eyed look, which I really am very grateful for many years later. So I think I'm going to stop and ask some questions. I'm not going to start today trying to go back and, you know, pick up the beginning of my life and talk about, among other things, why it took me so long to find companions and figure out a little bit about who I was. But I think I'm going to fit that in another time. So, questions. We have a few minutes left.
I want to thank you. That was a wonderful journey you were on and still are on. Amazing. We're the same age, so I know what was happening, but that was a very different path, and it was wonderful, everything you did. And you're such a humble man. One would never know that. So.
Thank you. Maybe you don't know me quite well enough. But I hope you're right.
I love revisiting Cal. I was there. I graduated in 81. 71. 61. 61.
21.
21. Yeah, 21. That's what I mean. I'm a year older than age. Anyway, I was happy to be back at Cal for a brief time to be talking.
And yeah, I mean, so if you were there in 61, you know how kind of quiet
it was lovely. Yeah.
I can't even believe what I'm hearing, because I got there in 69 and it doesn't resemble anything that I
remember. No, by that time
sleepy
it was
little blah blah blah.
I got there in 56. It was really sleepy. So I knew a couple of the guys who were the first, the opening wedge.
And it happened just at that point. I mean, between 56 and 60, yeah. The funding came through Pat Brown, and so mm-hmm. people began to...
Yeah, the fourth.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing, yeah.
Right, you could afford it. Okay. That's Karen.
Well, I'm curious about siblings, and so when you spoke about David and your trip to India, smiling and spotting flies and sleeping in that big bed, that those images you created, I wondered if your path and David's path, if he continued the way you
he did. He unfortunately got Hep C in India and eventually died of liver failure. But he had the same impulse. He was 6 years younger than I was. I have a sister who's 3 years younger. But I think his impulse was much the same as mine. And it did have to do with growing up for both of us in a rather kind of upper middle class waspish ghetto in New Jersey in Short Hills, which, mm-hmm. And you know, that's a kind of vacant space, and the stuff that goes on in a bedroom community doesn't give you a sense of, you know, what the world is like. How do you get out of it? You know, when I was 14, I went to Andover. Good luck getting out of the scene in Short Hills by going to Andover. And then I went to Harvard, but I finally managed to use music, especially Negro blues, to find my way into at least some connection with lives outside of this little fascinating and very, in some ways, magnetic subculture, which was WASP America.
Abby. It's interesting, too. The dates that you gave were very significant for me, because in 62 you came to the University of California. In 62 I was in my junior year of college at San Francisco State, and I'm a California native, so what happened to me in 74 when you arrived at San Francisco State was that I was living on the East Coast, so that my migration went the opposite way, and then eventually I came back, but you also were doing something that I did not do, which is to really, when you went to UC Berkeley, you settled in and you became connected with a place.
Yes.
And you did that also at San Francisco State. You really became connected with all of San Francisco because of what you were doing with your students, maybe more than San Francisco.
Yeah.
Whereas I left in 64, January of 64, went overseas, ended up in the East Coast, and for all those years until 74, I was moving from place to place. 74 is when I arrived in Washington, D.C., and then was there for 10 years, but I was always moving away from every place that I went to, and you honed in and became connected, and I find that very interesting, and would love to talk more with you about that.
Yeah, this California became my home in about 30 seconds.
It took me 2 minutes, I'd say.
I think seven for me. Seven.
Wow, that would be an experience to have. Mm. I'm interested to hear about that.
Mm. Yeah,
because I'm a native too, and you know, I can't fathom what you're talking about.
People don't appreciate it. We're born here. You have to be from someplace else.
Yeah.
And then as soon as you get here, it's like, oh my God, I'm leaving Chicago for this.
So I guess we should stop. But this is not the end of this kind of conversation. I'm going to be back on, what is it, March 15th?
I forget what it is. 3 weeks from now, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. And I mean, I'm going to be here every Friday, but I'm going to have another talk. And I want to talk about companionship and what it means and involve you in that discussion. And maybe between now and then you can think about, you know, the way in which your own lives and practice were stimulated by something you can call a companion.
Do you mean it differently than community? You use the word companionship where I think that...
I mean, a lot of times it's, first of all, individual people, not, I mean, the power of individuals in Ed's life, Suzuki Roshi, was it. I mean, he wouldn't be here without that connection.
He's your father.
Yes, yeah. My true father.
Yeah, that's right. So, and then, you know, there are individual experiences and things, and, you know, I want to talk more about that companionship stuff next time.
Carrie has a bunch of announcements, but I'll just make one, which is if anybody hasn't yet got a Sangha partner for the practice period, you can just let me know, and I'll have the pool of unpartnered people and make sure you have a partner. Carrie?
Yeah, I'm going to stand up.